headlines in UK's marking the death of its longest reigning monarch, amid calls in former colonies in the Caribbean to remove the British monarch as their head of state. The European Union remains divided over a plan to impose a price cap on Russian gas as the bloc's energy ministers gather to discuss what's been called an energy war with Moscow. And Iran test fires a new surface-to-surface domestically built missile during its military exercises. People in Britain are commemorating Queen Elizabeth II, who died at the age of 96 yesterday. Church bells tolled across Britain in tribute to the late Queen, who reigned for more than 70 years as Britain's monarch. Officials, including newly appointed Prime Minister Liz Truss, have been mourning the monarch's passing. Truss praised the Queen in a speech to Parliament, describing her as one of the greatest leaders the world has ever known. The British government has declared a 10-day period of national mourning. The Queen's eldest son, Charles, will be formally proclaimed king on Saturday morning. He's set to meet Truss and address the nation this afternoon. Calls are growing in former colonies in the Caribbean to remove the British monarch as their head of state. That after the ascension of Charles to the UK throne after the death of his mother, Queen Elizabeth II. Some Commonwealth leaders have expressed unease about the passage of leadership from Elizabeth to Charles. There are doubts about the role a distant monarch should play in the 21st century. In Jamaica and the Bahamas, people are calling for reparation and an apology for slavery. This is while Barbados, one of a dozen Caribbean nations which are Commonwealth members, ditched the Queen as head of state last year. Jamaica has signaled that it may follow suit. A survey shows 56% of Jamaicans favor removing the British monarch as the head of state. Activists in the region also argue that Charles's accession is an opportunity to redouble calls for slavery reparations. Said Puruza is joining us now from the British capital, London. Said, welcome to the program. First of all, I want to know what's going on over there in terms of the next few days and how the processions will take place. And after that, if you may, tell us what is the legacy that Queen Elizabeth II has left behind.
Over the past hour or so, Bardia, the new king, King Charles, has arrived in London with his queen consort, his wife, Camilla Parks Owens. They landed in West Ealing at an airport there, and he, of course, will be addressing the nation at around 6 p.m. And as you mentioned earlier, he will be proclaimed by the ministers and people in the government as the next monarch. As for the next 10 days, there will be several days of mourning that will be taking place across the United Kingdom and perhaps its foreign territories. Flags are at half-mast, as you probably can see above the Parliament here, where I'm standing, and across the devolved parliaments, legislative bodies in Northern Ireland, as well as in Scotland and Wales. And around, I think it's the September 16th is when the plan is for the Queen to be laid to rest. In the process, of course, she'll be laying in estate for heads of states and others to pay their respects, final respects to, before she is laid to rest on September 16th, according to the plan that we have learned about so far. Remind me of your other question, if you can, Bardia.
About the legacy that Queen Elizabeth II has left behind.
The legacy, really, she meant different things to different people. For people that have a lot of respect for her, believed in her as a source of stability for the country, as someone who steered the UK through some tough times, from the breaking up of the British Empire to royal scandals and to other massive developments that took place during her long reign around the world. And there are lots to other people beyond this group of admirers, she means very differently. For instance, people in countries who were subject to British colonialism, imperialism. This was an empire where the sun at some point wouldn't set, the famous quote there. The British Empire at one point in time commanding more than 23% of the world population up until 1913, rather. And so all these many countries from Africa, you're looking at Nigeria, Kenya, all the way to the Americas and to the Asia and the subcontinent, India, of course, is the perfect example of it, and how the people there over the course of centuries were subjugated, their wealth plundered and stolen by imperial colonialist Britain back then. Of course, when the Queen rose to power after the sudden death of her father, it was after a lot of really change. It was much change for the British Empire. She became the head of state that was later formed of the Commonwealth of Nations. Even so, since then, as you enumerated a little earlier, some of those countries have ditched her as the head of state and have become independent republics in their own right. A lot of important events unfolded during her long reign. For instance, around about the time she was taken over from her father, the putting down of the rebellion in Kenya against colonial Britain that was quelled brutally. At the time, 1.5 million Kenyans were put in concentration camps, civilians tortured and brutalized at the time. It was many years later, in the 2010s, after the work of Harvard historian Caroline Elkins that shed light on those documents that documented the brutality that happened at the time in Kenya and led to reparations being paid to some of the elderly Kenyans who were in those concentration camps. An example, of course, of India, several trillion dollars of wealth having been stolen from that country of several, more than a billion people, as well as in the rest of the globe. I'll give you an example that has to do with Iran, of course, the meddling by the MI6, the security apparatus here, in conjunction, in collusion with the Americans, in removing Iran's democratically elected government under Mohammad Mossadegh, Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, and reinstalling the Shah as if, you know, some favor from one fellow royal to another. Of course, those allegations of the Queen's direct involvement have since been ruled out. And also the role of the BBC, for example. It might be notable to mention that BBC Persian have closed their comments in social media because of the backlash. Of course, they will be receiving all the comments they'll be receiving from their Persian-speaking viewers, if you will. And so their involvement in that, and then a few years later in 1961, the Queen and her deceased husband, Philip's state visit to Iran.
All right, thanks a lot. Said Purazo joining us from the British capital, London. The EU remains divided over a price cap on Russian gas as energy ministers hold an emergency meeting over what European officials are calling an energy war. Hungary has warned that a price cap is against its own and European interests as it may prompt Russia to immediately cut gas supplies. The price cap proposal was introduced on Wednesday and has so far failed to win support from a majority of countries. European energy ministers met on Friday to find an agreement. EU leaders say the proposal will lower the costs of gas, allowing states to support vulnerable households and companies. Russia has warned that it will halt the supply of oil and gas to countries that impose price caps on its energy. European energy prices have skyrocketed as supplies from Russia grind to a halt. Moscow denies EU accusations of weaponizing its energy, blaming technical issues created by Western sanctions. Well, Iran has test-fired a surface-to-surface domestically developed missile as the Iranian army's ground forces wrap up 2 days of military exercises. The FAT-360 missile has a range of more than 120 kilometers. It can hit strategic targets at the speed of some 5,000 kilometers per hour. It can be launched from a multiple rocket launch system while communicating with satellites for quick navigation and utmost precision. The missile was test-fired in the second stage of Ekhtedar 401 drills in Isfahan province. The Army's infantry, armored, artillery, and electronic warfare divisions took part in the two-day exercises that began on Wednesday. Tehran expresses concern over reports of Albanian police trespassing on its embassy, saying Tirana will be responsible for any acts of violation against the Iranian diplomatic mission. The foreign ministry spokesman says if the reports are true, it has been a behavior contrary to international law and the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Rights. Nasser Kanani made the remarks after media reports that Albanian special police forces had broken into Iran's embassy for search operations. That after Iranian diplomats and embassy staff left the compound following Tirana's ultimatum on Wednesday, Tirana announced cutting ties with Tehran and asked the Iranian diplomats and embassy staff to leave within 24 hours. It cited an investigation into a recent cyber attack for the decision. Tehran says the decision is based on unfounded claims. It says Iran itself is a victim of cyber attacks and condemns the use of cyberspace as a tool to attack the critical infrastructure of other countries. Albania is a safe haven for the anti-Iran terror group MKO, which is responsible for the death of thousands of Iranians. Historian and social activist Alsi Jazeshi joins us now from Kuala Lumpur. Sir, welcome to the program. Please walk us through the recent events and how they've transpired with regards to the severing of ties, of diplomatic ties and relations between Albania and Iran. And also, if you may, bring us up to speed on the investigation that reportedly is taking place under the watch of Microsoft with regards to this alleged cyber attack that has taken place?
Well, Albania has become a hostile country to Iran since 2016, when it was ordered by the Americans to host the terrorist organization of Mujahideen al-Halk. Since their location to Albania, the Mujahideens, they have carried numerous cyber attacks and propaganda attacks and maybe even terrorist attacks against the Islamic Republic. These attacks, which go contrary to the penal code of Albania, have gone unpunished. The Albanian government learns about this, but they are afraid from the Americans to act. The Mujahideens are used in Albania by Israel, and if you see the Israeli medias today and yesterday, they are very happy with what Prime Minister Edi Rama is doing. Now, what happened in Albania is that in July 2022, the government institutions of Albania, they were hacked. It is not known who did this hacking, but in the time, the Mujahideens and Israelis and the medias that the Mujahideen have bought in Albania, everyone was claiming that it was Iran. This hacking group called Homeland Security, if I'm not wrong about the name, they were putting slogans against the Mujahideens, and they were saying why you host the terrorists in the country and so forth. Nevertheless, the government didn't exactly know whom to blame, but it seems that Microsoft Security, I don't know who are these people, but it seems they are a group within the Microsoft. Probably they have been paid by Israeli lobby or the Mujahideens. They have issued a report on 8th of September 2022, where they allege, without giving a clear proof, that hacking came from Iran. Now, even, let us say, even if hacking came from Iran, it doesn't necessarily mean that it was Iranian government. We have hackers nowadays throughout the world. We have hackers in the United States, in Europe, in China, and what have you. But what our prime minister did, he took an extreme and unheard step in the history of Albania. We had such a step actually only in 1946, when the communist government of Albania at the time, they expelled the American chargé d'affaires and diplomats from Albania, and they closed the American embassy. But now in 2022, Edi Rama is repeating what his father, because his father was a top apparatchik for the communist regime of Enver Hoxha. So Edi Rama now is repeating what his father and his colleagues did in 1946 by going into extreme and expelling the Iranian diplomats from Albania. I have to remind you that Albania is without an Iranian ambassador since 2018. And for people who read my articles or Israeli media, they might know that the expulsion of the Iranian diplomat from Albania was done on orders of Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel. So the latest attack against Iran most probably was coordinated with Israel, but very surprisingly, we had even the American and the British government, which in a way, they supported the extreme measure by Edi Rama. Now, Edi Rama, the prime minister, is having very difficult time in Albania. The opposition is accusing him, his brother actually, of being involved in the disappearance of a businessman, which was a rival of his brother, and he has so many scandals. So one explanation that we have in Albania about this is that probably because of his domestic affairs, he was forced to take this extreme measure.
Thanks a lot, historian and social activist Olsi Jezeshi, joining us from Kuala Lumpur. We're going to have to leave it there as we're running short of time. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Syria, Russia, Iran, and also China have condemned the looting of the Syrian people's wealth by the American occupation forces and demanded firm measures to prevent the smuggling of this country's oil abroad. Experts believe the continued stealing of Syrian oil by the United States is the main cause of the difficult humanitarian situations that Syrian citizens are suffering from. They say the looting of Syrian oil by Washington has reached its highest level, and this issue has caused the continuation of the dire humanitarian situations because millions of Syrian people suffer from lack of energy, food, water, and other essential materials. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some world media for further details. Please stay with us to hear more about this story. The Global Times wrote, recently the U.S. conducted fresh rounds of airstrikes in Syria, and meanwhile, its efforts to steal Syria's oil have come to a new high. The U.S. wants to be the world's police, but its practices expose that the country is merely a global hooligan, bully, and robber. According to the Syrian Arab News Agency, the U.S. occupation forces on Monday, August 29th, brought out 123 tankers loaded with Syrian oil from Al Jazeera fields toward Iraqi lands. The report said that the U.S. occupation forces on August 21st transported a convoy of 137 tankers filled with stolen oil to their bases in Iraq. On August 8, the Syrian Oil Ministry said that the U.S. and its mercenaries were stealing an average of 66,000 barrels of oil per day in Syria, about 80% of Syria's daily oil production. As a matter of fact, the U.S. has been stealing Syria's oil for several years, but now in the context of factors such as the ongoing Ukraine crisis, holding oil prices near their highest levels in years, the U.S. can gain far more from stealing Syria's oil. Tian Wenlin, a research fellow at the China Institutes of Contemporary International Relations, told the Global Times, "In this way, the U.S. also wants to weaken the incumbent Syrian government economically," adding, "By doing so, Washington hopes to use resources obtained in war to support that war and Takfiri terrorists, to sustain its military operations and expenditures in Syria and even the entire West Asia. As oil is a major pillar of Syria's economy, by stealing it, the U.S. is actually attempting to worsen West Asian countries' economy and undermine local people's livelihoods. But to a larger degree, the U.S. violations of Syria's sovereignty and plundering of West Asian countries' resources are for the sake of its own interest, that is, to advance more economic gains." The Modern Diplomacy website said the prolonged crisis in Syria has cost Syria's oil sector about $105 billion in direct and indirect losses. One might say that stealing Syria's oil is being done in order to impoverish the Syrian people so much so that they will turn against and overthrow Syria's president, Bashar al-Assad, whom even Western-sponsored polls, which have been taken for years in Syria, have shown to be overwhelmingly the one person whom they want to be Syria's president. However, whatever the reason might be as to why the U.S. regime is stealing Syria's oil, the U.S. regime theft is equally illegal and equally a gangster operation. That is, it is running there. This operation has been going on for a decade now under American presidents Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and currently Joe Biden. President Trump ordered the withdrawal of U.S. occupation forces from Syria in December 2018, but the Pentagon would not agree with the order, and the U.S. troops remain in two locations, one in the oil-rich northeast region and the other in southeast at Tanf. What does Washington truly care about in West Asia? Democracy, human rights, or good governance? The answer is none of these, but the access to resources such as oil. The chaos in the region can help the U.S. seize more natural resources and show its influence. Washington's recent airstrikes towards Syria and theft of its oil are a vivid demonstration that it is greed and interest that have dominated U.S. diplomacy, not democracy and good governance, as it has always claimed. For many years, the U.S. has launched countless wars in countries such as Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria under the banner of countering terrorism. It now appears that those counterterrorism operations are perhaps a tool to serve U.S. interest. Washington's talk of counterterrorism is only an empty one because, judging from the results, the U.S. and the rest of the world have not become safer. Instead, more chaos was brought to them because of Washington's so-called war on terror. Moreover, China daily has lambasted the continued plundering of the Syrian oil by U.S. occupation forces across the Arab countries, saying that the looting is a disgrace and a shame to Washington. The Daily made the assertion in an article published recently following reports that a convoy consisting of more than 100 U.S. military tankers had carried thousands of liters of crude oil from the northeastern Syrian province of Hasaka to the semi-autonomous Kurdistan region in northern Iraq, stressing that the matter shows the U.S. greedy appetite for oil is still not satisfied. The paper said it is easy to understand the fact that U.S. troops steal oil from Syria, as theft has long been their profession. Yet it is rather informative that the U.S. troops transported their stolen oil to Iraq, which is, in the general impression of the public, a country rich in oil. The top Chinese newspaper pointed out that the theft always reflects negatively on the people of the countries whose resources are stolen by the United States, underlining Iraq's high rates of poverty despite the country's richness in oil and other natural assets. The paper said despite being the fifth largest oil producer of the world, much of Iraq's population is still living in poverty, adding there might be many reasons, but pillaging by the U.S. is one of them. There have been many reports of the U.S. having seized and shipped gold out of the country. The U.S. military has stationed forces and equipment in northeastern Syria, with the Pentagon claiming that the deployment is aimed at preventing the oil fields in the area from falling into the hands of Daesh terrorists. However, Damascus maintains the deployment is meant to plunder the country's rich mineral resources. Former U.S. President Donald Trump admitted on more than one occasion that American forces were in the Arab country for its oil.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أَوْ يُوهُ بِلِيهِ اسْتَعِينُوا بِالصَّبْرِ وَالصَّلَاةِ.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, Minbar. A lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, this is the minbar you are listening to. May Allah accept your mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Today we invite you to listen to an English lecture by Brother Amin Rastani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. What we want to do tonight, inshallah, verses of the Quran that will push us to not give up on the aza of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Surah Hud, verse 120. One can say these verses highlight the philosophy and underlying reasoning for why we are continuing the aza of Imam Hussein till today. Sure, we have hadiths in this regard as well, but there will be general verses that will apply to the aza of Imam Hussein as well. Number one, Surah Hud, verse 120. If we are remembering Imam Hussein every year, recounting his history, everyone knows the history of Imam Hussein, yet when I go over the history, it seems that this is the first year it happened. Why do we continue this history, recounting again and again and again? Surah Hud, verse 120, is telling the Prophet about what happens when you recount the history of Awliyaullah in the past. وَكُلًّا نَقُصُّ عَلَيْكَ مِنْ أَنْبَاءِ الرُّسُلِ. We will tell you the story of all these prophets. O Prophet of Allah, we will tell you the story of previous prophets. مَا نُثَبِّتُ بِهِ فُؤَادَكَ. Number one reason. Number two reason. وَجَاءَكَ فِي هَذِهِ الْحَقِّ. Number three reason. مَوْعِذَةٌ. Number four reason. وَذِكْرَى لِلْمُؤْمِنِينَ. This verse of the Quran is letting the Prophet know that there are four benefits in recounting the story and stories of the Awliyaullah. Now you tell me, does this mean that it's only the prophets now? No, it applies to all Awliyaullah. Number one, ما نثبت به فؤادك. It strengthens your heart, O Prophet. This is the Prophet of Allah, who has the strongest heart, by the way. So you and I, when we go over the history of Imam Hussein, that is going to definitely be strengthening our hearts. How? When you hear of what Imam Hussein went through, yes? For you, of course, it's going to be much easier to make sacrifices. I mean, look, Prophet Nuh, the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the Quran tells him, O Prophet of Allah, Nuh was mocked for like 950 years. If you're going to be mocked for 23 years, don't worry. This strengthens the heart, correct? If Prophet Ayyub for 7 years suffered, we've heard his story, correct? He suffered. Physically suffered. Then, O Prophet, if for 3 years you're stuck in Sha'ib Abi Talib, that valley, when they were sanctioned, correct? They were besieged. 3 years in the advent of Islam, the Muslimin went through horrors in those 3 years. Famine and hunger, and to the extent that Abu Talib dies, Bibi Khadija dies a little after. It took a toll on the Muslimin. O Prophet of Allah, Ayyub went through 7 years of trial and tribulation. 3 years of Sha'ib Abi Talib, just letting you know this happens. Brothers and sisters, if that's how it works for the Prophet, and we hear the story of Imam Hussein alayhi salam again and again, then we know if a tragedy befalls me, and I say this all the time to our younger ones, when they have this idea of what does God have against me? Why am I going through this? Well, if having tragedy, if having hardship throughout life, equals Allah not liking me, then Imam Hussein must be the one that Allah doesn't like the most. Astaghfirullah. No. Tragedy sometimes has other reasons other than just Allah just not liking me. Alright? So Imam Hussein teaches us, if I'm reminded every year, that's going to give me a boost in my life. When we see the patience of Imam Hussein, we are patient. When we see his courage, when we see his forgiveness and taking grudges out of our hearts, no, I'm going to forgive this person once they actually come up to me and ask me for forgiveness. Well, it's one thing to be careful. If someone's hurt you once or twice, I'm not going to be the same with them anymore. That's for sure. But that doesn't mean I'm not going to forgive them. Well, whatever, I forgive them. Who cares? Whatever they did, huh? Whatever backstabbing, I forgive. I'm not going to let them backstab me again, though. I'm not going to be dumb about it, right? But at the same time, I'm going to forgive because Allah says forgive, and inshallah on the day of judgment Allah will forgive me. These are two different things here. I might not even talk to that person too much because once again, I've got to be careful. Right? My back only has so much room to get stabbed in. You know? But the other part, the grudge part, forget that. I ain't got time to worry about that. Imam Hussein, when Hur comes, oh Imam Hussein, will you forgive me? Imam Hussein, it's as if, alright? It's as if. If I'm going to translate what Imam Hussein says, I'm saying on Ashura is like, we don't got time for this like stuff, you know. You're come in. You're on this side now. Let's see what we got to do from here on. No, Imam was saying, I want you to forgive me this and that. Oh, you're here, finished. You ain't got time for this. We got a lot of work to do. So when I hear this every single year, Hur is a reminder to me. Manu thabbitu bihi fu'adak, his openness to letting everyone in. Yeah, all these things. All right. So that's number one. Number two, there has come to you in these stories, truth, haq comes to you. Brothers and sisters, Karbala, I don't care what anybody says, Karbala is the best example where you can easily draw a line between haq and batil. And man, when people actually get exposed the way they're supposed to Karbala, it will knock down dominoes all the way back to Saqifa. That's all I'll say. Yes, sometimes the dominoes will stop somewhere else. Sometimes they'll go all the way back. Because why? Because there's all haq versus all batil there. So people, they're going to see this. They're going to be like, whoa, wait a minute, what's going on? Now, I'll talk about this one some other night as well. There's like stories that I want to share with you. People who've written books on this. Yeah? لَقَدْ شَيَّعَنِي الْحُسَيْنِ. The guy writes a book called Verily Indeed Hussein Made Me Shia. Well, what's your story? These are things that we'll talk about, inshallah. So haq also comes through these stories. مَوْعِذَا. Ma'idha, usually they'll use the equivalent of preaching, that kind of thing, for mo'iza. So we have this in Urdu probably, in Farsi, okay? But they say, what's the difference between ma'idha, and one of the brothers, we were talking about this last night, he was telling me actually, what's the difference between ma'idha and hikmah? Shaykh Mutahhari, in a nutshell, he says, look, hikmah is any good, guidance that one, a person can give somebody else. But maw'idha is that which goes through the ears, doesn't go out through the other ear, but goes down to the heart and touches the heart and brings about change. Brothers and sisters, you tell me, the history of Imam Hussein, I don't know. As I said last night, if that's not going to work, nothing's going to work. The history of Imam Hussein. Yes, the repetitive, the one we've heard every year, history of Imam Hussein, is enough to change everything. Why? Because it goes down to the heart, doesn't go through the ears and out the other. Yes, the beautiful things that we do. Last night I pointed to this model here. Yeah, and so I wasn't sure who had done this. And yes, I was told that the scouts, CFK scouts, have done this. All right? This, whoever of our children makes this, it will remain with them forever, inshallah. These are the steps we should be taking as a community. Practical steps, making a difference. I still remember my science projects back in the day. You know those cardboard setups we used to have in science fairs? Remember those? I still remember that. I remember a lot of other things. Why? Because I got involved practically. The history, we got to be smart about it. We got to be efficient about it. For example, this VR thing that you guys got going on. Like, this is big stuff because this was the thing years ago, a few years ago when it started. Now, alhamdulillah, our communities have access to it. Wonderful. Inshallah, you make the most of these things. In one way or another, this history, they did their part. They gave us the raw material. Bismillah. Let me see what you do within the boundaries of Islam, of course. Let me see what you do with this. May Allah give all of you tawfiq in whatever you do in this regard. Maw'idha, it reaches the heart. Wa dhikra lil mu'mineen, a reminder for the mu'mineen. All right, so now, that's one verse. The history of the Rusul. You're not going to say that's going to apply to the history of Imam Hussein?
I swear to Allah, whenever I face troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call the back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. With medicines in short supply, power outages, and spare parts for electric scooters and wheelchairs increasingly unaffordable, disabled people in Gaza are enduring unimaginable suffering, says Ahmad Al-Samak, journalist, in an article published under the heading Siege of Gaza, Taking Terrible Toll on People with Disabilities. Stay tuned for more. Nidal Helis, 33, was waiting for his father to take him to the toilet. When Ashraf, 55, arrived from the mosque after praying, he lowered Nidal into his wheelchair and pushed him to the bathroom. Since birth, Nidal has had paralysis in his left leg, where bed sores have spread recently. His condition gradually worsened after he broke his patella 10 years ago following a fall from his wheelchair. Nidal said, while lying on a worn-out green sofa, "Bed sores have spread in my leg. They cause unbearable pain. Gazan doctors will have nothing to do with me. I can't bear my pain. All my neighbors hear me screaming in pain every single day." So that Nidal had undergone knee replacement surgery at Al Makassid Hospital in Al Quds, he and his father have applied to the Palestinian General Authority of Civil Affairs 5 times since August 2021. However, medical procedures have been delayed 4 times by the Israeli regime, as it does with almost half of Gazan patients, who experienced delays and bans from access to the West Bank, Al-Quds, under security pretexts, although the Palestinian Authority covers all costs. The measures are part of the Zionist regime's suffocating siege on the Gaza Strip, which is now in its 15th year. The land, sea and air blockade was imposed after Hamas won legislative elections in 2006. The Zionist regime has devastated social and economic life in the coastal enclave, and severe restrictions on the movement of people and goods have left 2 million Palestinians living in an open-air prison. According to a monthly report by the World Health Organization in April, the Zionist regime approved only 57% of entry permits by patients from Gaza. International human rights groups and UN mechanisms have characterized the siege as unlawful collective punishment. "We get a message a day before the appointment from the Authority of Civil Affairs that says our application is under consideration. Our security check, although I worked in the territories for more than a decade," said Ashraf, a father of 7, 6 of them unemployed, adding, "The alternative is to go to Egypt, but I can't afford the expenses, as I need at least $2,000. The worst thing is the 12-hour journey to Cairo and the 3-day return journey to Gaza due to Egyptian military operations in the Sinai Desert. How will my son bear that?" The father, whose main source of income is welfare payments from the Ministry of Social Affairs, needs up to $100 for Nidal's treatments every month. Feda Al-Rafi, 33, has hemiplegia, a condition caused by brain damage that leads to paralysis on one side of the body, and acidosis, a skin disorder. She needs an air conditioner and an air mattress, but due to the daily electricity outages in Gaza Strip, which last from 8 to 16 hours, and her family's financial situation, she cannot have them. "We can't afford a conditioner, so I have a fan, but we don't have another electricity source. When it cuts out, I sweat and have to scratch my skin. Then my skin bleeds," Rafi said, adding, "During the outages, I sleep on the ground without a mattress. Despite being painful for my back, sleeping in such a way is better than bleeding due to the heat." The electricity crisis badly affects people with disabilities in Gaza, as it means there is no power for lifts or for charging of electric wheelchair batteries and air mattresses, among other things. My mobility scooter battery needs 4 hours to be fully charged. The problem is that I go to sleep early. The electricity returns at 10 p.m. on the 3 or 4 days a week, and it cuts off at 6 a.m. before I wake up, Rafi said, adding, because I can't charge my scooter and therefore leave my home, I often have to cancel my appointments. The poverty rate in Gaza is 53%, and the medicine Rafi needs, which costs up to $200 a month, is too expensive for her father, Muhammad, 56, to afford. All her body is supposed to be covered with creams 3 times daily, especially when the electricity outages cause her to start sweating, said Muhammad, an electrical technician and a father of 10, adding, sometimes we can't find her medicine in Gaza, so we have to buy the alternatives, which are not effective. But she doesn't suffer from the lack of medicine as much as she does from the electricity outages. Human Rights Watch issued a report in 2020 that said a decade of Israeli regime restrictions have robbed people with disabilities in Gaza of their freedom of movement, as well as access to the devices, electricity, and technology they need to communicate or leave their homes. Muhammad Amrin, 33, a father of 3, has cerebral palsy and completely depends on his mobility scooter. Due to the Gaza siege, the price of spare parts for scooters and electric wheelchairs has soared. My scooter has been out of order for more than a year, and I can't afford the 1,500 shekels it would cost to repair it, so I have to walk on my crutches for 50 minutes every day to find a cheap ride, said Amrin, who has a diploma in accounting he has never been able to use. I have a stand at a secret market and work from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. for around 25 shekels a day. The taxi fares cost me 8 shekels daily. If the price of spare parts ever become affordable again, I would repair my wheelchair and save the 8 shekels for my family, he said. Some local civil society groups grant people with disabilities a new electric wheelchair every 2 or 3 years, depending on funds. The NGOs include the National Society for Rehabilitation, Baslam for Social Rehabilitation, Society of Physically Handicapped People, and others. Most of them are run by Gazans, but funded by regional and international organizations and countries. Amrin said, I received mine, which is out of order, in 2018. When I asked if I could get a new one, the society told me there was no funds. Of the 2.17 million Palestinians in Gaza have disabilities, according to the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics. The quality of spare parts for electric wheelchairs and mobility scooters is poor. They are not always available, and their prices are high, said Ali Al-Hendi, the owner of a workshop for electric wheelchairs. The motherboard price is 1,500 shekels compared to 600 shekels in 2012. The average price of a charger is 800 shekels, up from $100 in 2012. I tried to import secondhand electric wheelchairs and mobility scooters last year, which banned me from doing so. The prices have tripled and quadrupled because of the siege, Hendi said, adding, 10 years ago, I used to carry out 2 or 3 projects a month for local societies to maintain electric wheelchairs and scooters. Now, I do one every 2 or 3 months. Due to the deteriorating situation, donors tend to fund relief rather than developmental projects, said Jamal Al-Rosi, director of the National Society for Rehabilitation. A relief project provides humanitarian aid to the needy people during and after a crisis. In contrast, development projects aim to generate a source of income for people with disabilities in the long term through various small economic projects, he said. Besides the lack of spare parts and the catastrophic effects of the electricity outages on people with disabilities, foreign funds have been dramatically increased. The fund my society has received recently is 60% less than before the siege. Unfortunately, we were forced last year to terminate a long-term project for 2,000 Gazans with disabilities due to the lack of funds. According to the Fourth Geneva Convention, denying disabled people access to hospitals in the West Bank and banning medical equipment could constitute to war crimes, said Salah Abdul Ati, a human rights expert and director of the International Commission to Support Palestinian People's Rights. He said, "There must be an intervention by the international community to break the siege of Gaza and to allow the entry of all medical equipment and devices to people with disabilities." Nidal has a new appointment on August 8 at Al-Maqasid Hospital, he said. "I appeal to all people to help me receive my treatment. Doctors warn me that if I don't have my leg treated, I will get gangrene and might have to have my leg amputated. Please, I don't want this."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on July 27, 2023. 2022.
The existence of the Islamic Republic has challenged and proven the falsity of the core identity of Western civilization. That is what irritates the Western powers, and they are angry. The reality of the Western powers is that they are a mafia. At the top of this mafia stand the Zionists, prominent Jewish businessmen, and the politicians that obey them. The US is their showcase, and they have spread out everywhere. This is the truth about the Western powers. They cannot tolerate this. So they are constantly thinking up new plans to do something against the Islamic Republic. For example, a topic that is being spoken about a lot recently is the topic of women in an Islamic society. Of course, it's a topic that has been spoken about since the beginning of the revolution. They falsely claim that they wanted to help and support Iranian women. And it is a topic that recently they have brought up again regarding hijab and similar issues. And they are repeating their previous failed attempts once again.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A few years ago, someone asked me, "What defense do you have against the West regarding the issue of women?" My reply was, "I don't have a defense. I am the one that attacks. They are the ones who need to defend themselves. They are the ones who need to answer. They treat women like merchandise. Defense? I don't need a defense. We are the claimants in the case of women." Now, what's this all about? When we see a sudden uproar in the official British and American media, by their followers and by those hired by them, when they all suddenly start to attack on issues regarding women and use excuses such as hijab and other matters, what do you think is the reason behind this? Why do they do these things? Do they really want to defend Iranian women and their rights? Aren't they the ones who would cut off the water supply to our people if they had the chance? They feel sorry for Iranian women? They have used sanctions to block access to medicine for children with butterfly disease. For children! They've placed all kinds of sanctions against the people of Iran. They're concerned about Iranian women? Can anyone believe such a thing? So what is this all about? The fact is that honorable, talented Iranian women are amongst those who have struck the Western civilization one of the hardest blows. So, they hold a grudge. Women have done this.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our